Namaste, everyone. Welcome. This is going to be an interesting session because we're live streaming on two different platforms today. So the original plan was Nupur was also going to be joining us, and we were going to discuss both the Supreme Court judgments of Sabarimala and the Ram Janmabhoomi. But unfortunately, Nupur could not make it. So you're stuck with me. So as of now, we are having two live viewers right now. We have the viewership of the Charvak podcast and obviously of the Op India podcast too. So very well welcome to all of you. Well, basically all, whether you're on Op India or on the Charvak podcast, you're used to seeing me. So I would first want to start by welcoming Jai Saidi Paksai. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, bhai.
All right. So Sai, let's start with Sabarimala first. Yes. And then we'll go into Ram Janmabhoomi. So let's begin with this. Before I ask you questions about the judgment itself, because I've taken a few notes about the judgment itself. So first, tell me your thoughts on, and if you could summarize, what was the judgment basically about? So what are your thoughts about the judgment and what is the judgment about?
See, I think it's important for people to understand what is it that we asked for, and then understand the whole thing in the context of what was asked. So the primary ground in the review petition was that the entire concept of Naishthika Brahmacharya had not been understood or appreciated by the majority of the previous bench. And that is the reason why it affected their own ability to formulate the propositions under the heading of what constitutes an essential religious practice. Second, something very, very fundamental was the rule of the Kerala Temple Entry Rules of 1965, that is Rule 3, which was being applied to the temple of Sabarimala. We contested the very application, saying that the history of the legislation and the history of the temple clearly show that the rule does not apply to that particular temple. And as a consequence of which, two different implications arise. One, the rule which doesn't apply to the temple is forcibly being applied to it. And the temples to which the rules apply don't get an opportunity to present their point of view to defend the rule. Okay. So these were the two points. The third point that we had pointed out was that when a religious community or a specific denomination or a body of devotees specifically say that this is the practice of the temple which is relatable to the character of the deity, and they have produced documented evidence of showing at least 300 years of uninterrupted existence of that particular practice, then clearly nobody is committing a fraud on the court, and therefore the court has to accept what the community is saying. Because the court cannot don the hat of a theological institution or an ecclesiastical institution and go down the path of a religious inquiry, because it is not trained to do so. It's a secular constitutional court. So these, and importantly, we had also raised the question of whether people who fundamentally do not believe in the deity and who don't understand or accept the traditions of the temple can file a PIL, because someone who doesn't have faith or astha cannot seek the right of access or entry into that particular place of worship. So just as it would be improper to apply the rules of religion to a secular place, it would be equally unjust to apply the rules of secularism to a place of worship. The two templates are different, the two platforms are different, and the two expectations are completely different. So all these have effectively translated to the seven questions which have been identified by the majority judgment in yesterday's verdict. And unfortunately, the minority verdict has not taken into account, according to us, rather the minority view, it's not a verdict, it's not binding at all, has not taken into account the submissions made in the review petitions, and it has not dealt with them. So I do believe that this is, a huge shot of confidence for people who stand by the temple and its practices and by the devotees and the deity. I also believe that contrary to the myths that are floating around in public domain, perhaps motivated, perhaps inadvertent, I cannot comment on it, that this has no bearing on the previous verdict of 28th of September 2018. I think that would be a slightly unlettered position if somebody has not read paragraphs 4, 6, 7, 8, and 9 of the judgment. And that is also reflected in, let's say, the position that's been taken by the state government of Kerala today, that they would not encourage the entry of publicity mongering or publicity hungry activists into the temple the way they perhaps did over the last 1.5 years, especially after the pronouncement in last September. I don't wish to comment on any particular individual. I'm simply saying that this is the perception. So I think people can draw their own conclusions. So as far as I'm concerned, this judgment effectively vindicates our position that the previous judgment did not take into account our position based on law, not religious sentiments. Okay. So nobody needs to interpret this as a position which is based on religious sentiments or this is a position based on faith. It is a position based on faith as captured by the law and under the constitution. That's how it needs to be seen.
All right. So now let's get into the questions or the doubts that I had. So I was just having a cursory look at the judgment itself. And, for first comment is, you know, thank goodness it is only 70 pages, unlike the Ram Janmabhoomi, which basically sucked the living daylights out of me. It was 1,000 pages. I was like, in this entire process, my respect for lawyers has increased a lot and my respect for judges has decreased a lot because they actually write these long ass things that lawyers have to read all the time. So my respect for your kind, your tribe has increased a lot.
Now you know why most of us sport a pair of specs and why most of us have premature graying of hair.
Yeah. So I just have a few confusions. Like, so basically let's start with what was this 0.5 on page 6, 7 and 8, which is basically the crux of the judgment, right? Those right. Yeah, 7 points that are raised by the judges.
Correct.
So can you start with, so point number one is that regarding the interplay between freedom, between the freedom of religion under articles 25 and 26 of the constitution and other provisions in part 3, particularly article 14. Now, what are the courts trying to say when they say the interplay between article 25 and 26?
Let me just open the judgment so that I comment with better information in front of me. Mm. So the first one says regarding the interplay between the freedom of religion under Article 25 and 26 and other provisions in Part 3, particularly Article 14. Why does this become relevant? Is the position that was taken by people who support the temple, women who support the temple, because People for Dharma effectively is an organization run by women, like Ms. Shilpa Das, Padma Pillai and Anjali George. The position that was taken was that people who do not have faith cannot exercise or assert rights under Article 14 because they certainly don't have rights under Article 25. They don't believe in the deity because they have not said so in the writ petition. And therefore, equality is something that they cannot assert when fundamentally they are unequal in terms of their own respect for the deity. That's point number one. Two is Article 14 is effectively a provision that is to be applied or asserted against the state, not against a temple. And we had convincingly established that this particular temple is not a state-run temple. There is not a single penny that the temple gets from the state by way of charity. It's not a state-funded temple, although it's a state-managed temple because of, again, the same HRC legislations that we have encountered in Tamil Nadu and other places. But that does not take away the character of the temple as an autonomous institution. And the Travancore Devaswam Board, which effectively governs this particular temple, is also meant to be a delegatee, an agent of the temple in enforcing the traditions of the temple, but not questioning the traditions of the temple. Okay, so our position was Article 14 is fundamentally inapplicable against this particular institution, which is why the argument moved towards Article 15, which is the right of women. Okay, so our position was even Article 15 is very clear that it does not mention a public place of worship in the specific places it clearly captures. So if the framers of the constitution were clear enough to leave a public place of worship outside the scope of Article 15, that is to respect the religious diversity of India, especially the religious diversity of 80% of the population, hopefully until the next census comes out, which is to say that there are traditions which are gender specific as far as Hinduism is concerned. Therefore, we need to be careful in applying gender justice to those temples and those faith systems which have a certain gender specific approach. So there are places which are specific to women, those spaces which are specific to men, then those spaces which are specific to, I don't know what is the correct term today because LGBTQ has also become politically incorrect. Let's just call it intersex and other communities. Okay. So all these have been taken into account according to me. Therefore, you can't try and assert your individual rights over an institution which belongs to a community where certain rules have to be respected. That is what is the scope of the discussion under point number one. And I'm giving you a broad, crude scope because there is a lot that can be said under it that itself is capable of, let's say, occupying an entire book of at least 300 pages. But largely speaking, this is what point number one relates to, or question number one relates to.
All right. So then a follow-up to that would be, you just mentioned the gender specificity, right, within the judgment. And what the judgment was basically dealing with gender specificity, to be very precise. But then I found something very confusing in the judgment where the, you know, when the judges in the judgment itself, they have spoken about, you know, the Parsi matter and the mosque matter, and then the entry into mosques, the entry into Parthi Agyaris, and female genital mutilation. Now, here's my thing. I still, in fact, when I was looking into the you know, the dissenting judgments where, of the two judges, in fact, my worry stems from there. And my worry as in, I mean, I just want to clarify, I might be a Gnostic. My worry is not from a religious person's point of view. My worry stems from a purely freedom-loving person's point of view. A person, because there is no freedom if you don't fight for the freedom of the Astika also as an Astika. I believe a Gnostic's primary job is to fight for the freedom of Astik, and an Astik's primary job is to fight for the freedom of a Gnostic. Now, my worry was when I was reading the dissenting judgment is, they have actually, you know, they have left the door open for a lot of confusion, and clarify this confusion for me. Now, they say they have made this into an issue of impurity again in the dissenting part of the judgment. I'm not saying that the judgment says that, but again, in the dissenting part of the judgment, we keep on hearing the same thing about, oh, this is about impurity. But it is not about impurity. You guys have given the evidence. But then how can the judges still mention something like this when it is as clear as daylight? My problem is that it might be about impurity in the masjid's case. It might be. I don't know what the case is with the Parsis, so I'm not going to comment on that. And FGM is a completely different rule, which in my view just basically violates the harm principle. If we, I mean, nothing else, it violates, you know, John Stuart Mill's harm principle. But my issue is that how have the courts still not been clear about this basic fact that Sabarimala is not about impurity?
Because facts can do only so much to change perceptions. And if you think that facts alone can change perception, frankly, that is not how it works. We tried our best to capture every aspect of the position, covered as many bases as possible, conceivable and even inconceivable. We tried to go the whole hog. But it seems that if positions have already been taken and it's difficult to budge or, let's say, dislodge people from those positions. And I don't wish to make any personal comments here because at the end of the day, I respect the institution that I practiced before and I don't think it's right to comment on any particular individual. So I'm going to comment on the opinion, which is clearly coming through the dissenting opinion. And I think in my response to the questions that were asked by Swarajya, Op India and other places, including BBC today, I've clarified that my position with respect to the dissenting opinion is that it has not even addressed the most fundamental and the most important of questions raised in the review petitions. It has reiterated its position. It has not answered our questions on the basis of facts or on the basis of logic that we have presented. And that is a respectful position that I'm entitled to take as a representative of the parties in court, as well as an individual and someone who certainly believes in these causes. So, I don't think we should worry too much about that because I'm sure that there are any number of people who are open to accepting a different point of view once facts and logic are presented to them. I don't think you should be too worried about that. And we should respect everybody's right to hold their opinions. I don't think you should worry about that at all. Now, coming to the larger question of clubbing and all that, see, this is something which is extremely case-specific. So, pardon me if I'm being a bit obscure and perhaps a bit too detail-oriented here. The original writ petition that was filed in 2006, writ petition 373 of 2006, basically said it had two prayers. The first prayer was specific to the temple of Sabarimala and the second prayer was broad, applying to multiple places of worship and all places of worship across all religions, to be fair to the petitioners. And here I'm someone who's still fair in pointing out what is right and what is wrong. So to be fair to the petitioners, they had both these prayers. Both these prayers were actually captured by the judgment of Justice Deepak Mishra of 13th of October 2017, when he referred the matter for the very first time to the Constitution Bench. And both these prayers were captured. In fact, today in my responses to Swaraj and other platforms, I've actually captured that prayer. And therefore, the majority is right in actually looking at this entire issue holistically, because that is what the writ petitioners wanted. And most importantly, the object of the court clubbing all these matters is not to say that all these matters are similar, or they are connected, or they are related, or they merit any kind of comparison, but because the common strain which is running behind the sentiment of the Supreme Court's question is, in general, when it comes to religion, should a court intervene? If it can, how much can it intervene? What are the contours of that particular intervention? What is the Lakshman Rekha of that particular intervention? What is the test that a court is supposed to adopt, apply, and approach with if it chooses to deal with these matters and adjudicate these matters? So that is the sense in which this has been clubbed. Not to say that female genital mutilation is the same as barring the entry of a certain group of women as far as Sabarimala is concerned. But since you're on that point, you also have to ask this question. Why is only female genital mutilation an issue before the court? What happens to MGM, male genital mutilation in the Muslim community?
Circumcision. Yeah.
So to what extent will the court actually sit and comment on these issues? Will it actually get into the Old Testament with respect to circumcision? What is the object behind it? What is the theology or what is the faith system behind it? Frankly speaking, the sentiment that I certainly endorse is the sentiment which is the court's ability to intervene in faith-related matters must be peppered with oodles of circumspection and caution. That cannot be evaded at all. I think that is the position that most advanced jurisdictions when it comes to legal systems and constitutional systems adopt, particularly when you have only secular courts and you don't have religious courts to do justice to religious matters.
All right, then let us connect this to another topic, which is going to be used all the which is raised all the time, is this essential religious practice. Now, here's my question to you.
Right. As
a person, I mean, this whole base of essential religious practice stems out of a very Christian morality. In fact, you know, if when I was reading through the judgment, what stood out for me in the Sabarimala judgment, I mean, right from page 58 till the last one, it was like a whole gatha of Western judgments and Western morality and Western things. And, you know, they go into Russia, they go into England, they go into John Stuart Mill.
Feminist authors and whatnot.
Yes, whatnot. I was like, from page, the highest amount of, Vakhan, in Gujarati, there is a word called Vakhan, as in, you know, gathai likhi gayi hai. It was like 12 to 15 pages of bloody what is Western law, what is Western morality, what is Western this, what is Western that. I mean, I was actually flabbergasted when I read the judgment, because I was like, I don't want to speak to you and not be prepared. So I want to connect this, because there is morality, then there is constitutional morality, and within this interplay between morality and constitutional morality, according to these people, where they are trying to justify it from a very Judeo-Christian Western framework, is the concept of essential religious practices. Now, how my biggest problem and my worry, if you remember, as soon as the judgment came, my first words were badaiyo, and the second words were that I am very worried. I immediately told you I am very worried, because this essential religious practice is a Western dogma. I use the word dogma with full responsibility, because what is essential for a South Indian Hindu may not be essential for a North Indian Hindu. So how are we going to find a way out of this conundrum?
What is essential for a Hindu in a southern part of India cannot be essential for a Hindu from the same southern part of India, from the same state, but coming from a different region. That is the extent of diversity.
Yeah.
So I remember reading this book on the drought situation. I think by this Sainath, P. Sainath, of course, I disagree with him on a lot of things, but I think his books are decent, at least some of the books, that this country is so diverse that every 15 kilometers, the dialect of a certain language changes. Okay, the idiom changes, the rolling of the tongue changes, the pronunciation changes, everything changes. What he called as Vakhan is nothing but Vyakhyan from Sanskrit. That's it. Okay, if you go to heartland Hindi, let's say Hindi heartland, it'll become Vakhan. Okay.
Yeah.
So Vakhan, from Vyakhyan to Vakhan, this is how it actually, the apabhranch is how it actually originates. Now, the thing is, our entire position has been, and this is something that I wrote for the Open magazine just recently, a 3,000-word piece capturing the Ayodhya verdict's take on juristic person of personality of a deity. where I've analyzed the entire judgment, and my criticism has been that even for vestation of juristic personality on a Hindu deity, which is a thoroughly Hindu concept, which is thoroughly an Indic concept, which has originated from the soil of this particular country, you've had to justify your entire analysis on the basis of Roman law, English law. Not one reference was made to Pandurang Vaman Kane's authoritative treatise on the history of Dharmashastras, which I think is a book that must be made mandatory reading. It's a volume, 16-volume treatise. They have not even referred to that. The Hindu deity receives its validation in the eyes of the democratic, social, or let's say, constitutional republic of India, and through the Supreme Court by validation on the anvils of English law and Roman law.
That's my worry. That's why I told you I'm so worried about this.
So the entire issue has been to try and take away the gradual Abrahamization of, let's say, legal concepts and approaches, at least with respect to Hindu issues. You apply Abrahamic logic to Abrahamic faith, no problem. That is how it is supposed to be done. But when it comes to the Hindu faith, you apply our concepts, which is why on the issue of religious denomination, our point was a religious denomination as understood in the context of Abrahamic communities is very different from the concept of a sampradaya when it comes to Hindus. So religious denomination must be interpreted as a sampradaya in the context of Hindus and can be applied and interpreted in toto as a religious denomination for non-Hindu Abrahamic communities. That's been our position.
Yeah, and just, you know, because we have to cover the Ram Janmabhoomi too, and I'm trying to get the crux of as much. So just one last point.
Right.
I found this also one positive. I mean, I'm trying to look up the point. I think it was one positive that I got out of the judgment. I wanted to know your comments also was where the judges clearly categorically mentioned in the judgment itself, there was then attempt made from the, you know, the other side, where they were actually trying to say that Sabarimala is not even a Hindu temple because many people go there. That was also an argument given. I was shocked when I read that argument in the judgment itself. And so I just want to praise the court that they dismissed that argument lock, stock and barrel. And
no, going by that argument, Mohinuddin Chisti was not a Muslim.
Yes. Yes. And it's very interesting that the judges in the judgment itself, they mention the example of a Sufi shrine. They say, are a lot of Hindus go to Sufi shrine. So even they are not a word. So
right.
So I found that whole shenanigan to be very, very confusing. So what do you think? So just one last word on the Sabarimala judgment, and then we can go into the Ram Janmabhoomi one. Is another thing that has led to a lot of confusion is that people are saying that now with this being sent to a larger bench, it means that nothing changes and women are still going to be allowed inside the temple. So can you clarify what is the official legal statement or the stand on that?
See, there is no doubt that as far as the judgment of the majority is concerned, it could have been more clearly worded on this particular aspect. However, once a straight line is drawn, nobody needs to say, look, this is how a straight line looks and therefore it's a straight line. That makes no sense at all. So if the majority view has already taken a position that there are serious questions as far as the legal and factual underpinnings of the verdict is concerned. And there is also the question that is raised with respect to the very application of the rule that was considered to be applicable to the temple of Sabarimala. When these questions are raised, what are they actually saying, if not for the fact that there are serious reservations with respect to the application or the validity or the enforceability of the judgment? That is effectively what they have said. And fortunately, I think the state government of Kerala has, for a change and for a refreshing change, understood the sense, the substance, the spirit and the pith and marrow of the majority view. And they've taken the position that they will not entry for publicity hungry activists into the temple and that they will respect the sentiments of the devotees of Ayyappa. That's a position that I think has come only because even they have understood the import of it. Unfortunately, I think the media and certain other people who are not happy with the outcome are obviously saying, no, it doesn't use the word stay. Therefore, there is no stay. That's how they are talking about it. I think it's a question of how you judge the impact of yesterday's verdict on the continued validity, if at all, of the 2018 verdict. I think that's where the matter ends.
All right. Now let's move into the Ram Janmabhoomi verdict. My personal thoughts, obviously, after reading both the judgments was, I think the Ram Janmabhoomi verdict, if from a layman's point of view, I don't understand.
Layperson, layperson, not layman.
LA person. Yeah. You just Justin Trudeau'd me. So from a lay person's point of view, I would say that I was far more satisfied from a philosophical point of view, although not entirely satisfied from a philosophical point of view with the Ram Janmabhoomi judgment. But okay, just like we had a basic summary in the Sabarimala, so my first request to you would be, can you summarize the Ram Janmabhoomi movement? Then I would get into the questions with you.
See, outcome is as follows. One, Nirmohi Akhada, which was asserting its rights as the trustees or the Shebayats or the Sevayats of Sri Ram Lalla, their suit has been dismissed because it was barred by limitation, which is a specific aspect of law. It's a different nuance, meaning thereby that claim was beyond time. The claim of the Sunni Waqf Board has been dismissed because it was unable to prove its case on title, possession or adverse possession. The case of Sri Ram Lalla, the plaintiff himself, the deity himself, was decreed, it was accepted, and the entire disputed property has been directed to be transferred to the deity himself. As far as Gopal Singh Visharad, one of the other Hindu plaintiffs who was a representative of the Hindu Mahasabha is concerned, his right to pray at his place, at Ram Lalla's place of worship, has been upheld. So this is the broad outcome. And the court has exercised its powers under Article 142, a ghair mamooli, an extraordinary power, to grant 5 acres of land, either within Ayodhya itself or within the 67 acres acquired by the central government under the Ayodhya Act of 1993. So the court has actually left that particular decision to the central government or the state government to decide where that piece of land must be allotted. This is the broad outcome. But I think, like mathematics, it's not enough for you to actually arrive at a conclusion. There is a lot of weightage given to the step marks, which is the reasoning. What is the reasoning that you have adopted to arrive at a certain conclusion? And in law, it applies all the more, or it matters all the more, because it affects not just this matter, but even future matters. Okay? And people need to know how evidence has been weighed, how has it been considered, what kind of scientific evidence, what kind of faith-based evidence, if not faith alone or faith per se, all of these have been considered. There, I believe that there is a certain amount of justice done to the ASI report, but the court somehow steers clear of the entire question of whether a temple was demolished. It's almost as if the court doesn't want to answer the question.
Yes.
And that is really problematic, because while the court seems to be very comfortable answering the question of what happened on 6th of December 1992, it doesn't want to answer as to what happened in 1528 or whenever it is when the temple was demolished. Well, there are multiple sources. At the very least, the court has to ask itself, how did the disputed structure, allegedly known as the Babri Masjid, come into existence if previously there was a temple there and there was no vacant land according to the court on which the mosque was built? Then how was the mosque built? What led to its construction? What is the history surrounding it? So many witnesses have been examined on it. So many documents have been presented on it. At least the court must get into that analysis. Unfortunately, the court has completely circumvented that particular discussion. I think for an institution which loves and which takes pride in being the voice of dissent and all that, I think the court should have done justice to facts. Whether they're politically correct or incorrect shouldn't have made a difference. Whether they're palatable or unpalatable shouldn't have made a difference. Whether they are true, whether they are justified, whether they have some basis or foundation. That should be the only thing that should have mattered.
Yeah, just to, basically add even more value to the point, I'm just sharing the screen for the viewers so that they understand how much the courts have ordered. I mean, as you see in the screen, I mean, this is, the emphasis is not added by me. The emphasis is added by the courts. So see this funny thing. Now, the court says, now viewing in totality and taking into account the archaeological evidence of a massive structure just below the disputed structure and evidence of continuity in structural phases from the 10th century onwards up to the construction of the disputed structure, along with the yield of stone and decorated bricks, as well as mutilated sculpture of divine couple and carved architectural yada yada yada. Look at the last line. Are indicative of remains which are distinctive features found associated with temples of North India, but they don't call it a temple. The court. So, I mean, I am just flabbergasted. Then again, page 563, emphasis added by the courts. Again, look, the last line, I have not made it bold. The courts have made it bold. Indicative of remains which are distinctive features found associated with temples in North India. But the courts have not said it is a temple. Yeah, mere to samajh ke bahar hai. Fir what more did the courts need? I mean,
correct.
I mean, I don't get it. Where am I missing something? I mean, I was looking through the evidence. Obviously, I had gone through the evidence at the Allahabad court judgment, which was, I don't know what they had, what problems the judges have in life. The 5,000 pages, bloody hell. What the hell, yaar, jindagi barbaad kar doge logon ki 5,000 page ki koi judgment likhta hai. Ye 1,000 page thi, wo 5,000 page thi. So I was just going through the evidence and, you know, thank goodness, Meenakshi Jain, jaise logon ne books likh di hai to summarize for people. But my point is, the evidence
actually,
is...
Actually, books end up being crisper and shorter than some of the judgments.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, you look at the archaeological evidence, the dating goes right up to 2,000 years ago. 2,000. Right. I mean, it is a continuing civilizational proof. Right. And still, I mean, what... My whole question to you is, what more proof was needed legally?
Not just that, okay? RSS is a fascist organization. BJP is a fascist organization. Everybody is a fascist organization. How do these people matter? I don't think we should even get into that at all. However, there is enough proof of the fact that Nihang Sikhs have gone to that particular place, okay? Because they believe that they are Vaishnavite warriors and that is their tradition. They have chosen to go to that particular place and they have fought alongside Ram devotees, pitched battles on the occasion of Ram Navami from Hanuman Gadi and whatnot. So there is enough proof that is coming from all over the place. But see, I think people must wake up and see the facts for themselves. There's nothing that you can do. And notwithstanding all these facts, the court records the demolition of December 6, 1992, this and that and everything under the sun, but somehow doesn't wish to record the fact that there was indeed a non-Islamic structure which was raised and which was pulled down. Now, as far as I'm concerned, who pulled it down? What was the motivation for pulling it down? All that is different. We don't need to get into that. However, it was pulled down is something that is at least demonstrable through facts. Okay. Unfortunately, I don't understand the reluctance of fora or let's say Indian fora in general to address these kind of issues. You don't want to set up a commission for truth and reconciliation. You don't want to address these issues even in judgments, particularly when facts are being presented. So I ask myself, which forum is actually going to take up these issues and address them for the sake of posterity, for the sake of closure? Because this is still, according to me, a slightly uneasy closure because you have not addressed the central issue.
Not only has the central issue not been addressed, my another weird problem is because of this lacuna that the courts have left, have you seen again after the judgment a litany of articles from the expected sources where once again, there is no evidence. And I don't get it. Now, like the shameless creatures of the highest order are the historians in this country. I mean, the leftist historians. So they will write something on scroll and wire. And then in the courts, the same people, when they are under oath, where they are on record, they say something completely different. I mean, why can't the courts...
Half of these people don't even volunteer to the witness box as expert witnesses on subjects that they hold forth on a regular basis to take an oath, take the stand, subject yourself to cross-examination. Let us see what is it that you're exactly made of. What is this expertise that you keep touting on a regular basis? What is the scholarship and erudition that does not seem to have the courage of its conviction to present itself in a court of law for scrutiny on the annals of evidence? That's a question that we must ask. So that means you're only good for lit fests. But where it actually matters and where history is being made, where history is being discussed, where history is being dissected, you don't seem to have the guts to walk your talk. That's how exactly that has happened.
Yeah, and not only that, and the funny part was, so I mean, when the courts were explaining, so in the judgment, they were looking at the archaeological evidence. And then, I mean, what I found funny was their comments on archaeology as a science. That was hilarious. To me, as a, you know, as a Gnostic.
I don't want to comment on any of that as a practitioner.
Yeah, I know. I mean, but I'm telling you, I was laughing. I had a hearty laugh when the courts comment on archaeology as a science. I mean, we don't know if it is sure. Huh? Come on, yaar, what do you know? How do you not know it is sure or not? See, what I found, my whole takeaway was, look, within the parameters, I want to say it very clearly, within our socio-political parameters, I think the courts have done a fantastic job in the judgment in the Ram Janmabhoomi. I'm giving them credit where it's due. But my point is, again, I'm scared. Why am I scared is, even the Ram Janmabhoomi case has been framed in the same so-called Judeo-Christian purview and morality. It scares me. Because this country is so diverse and is so plural, that as an average citizen, my worry is, can I ever seek justice in this country as a Hindu, is what worries me.
See, as on date, I think the situation is such, jo milta hai le lo. That is how pathetic the situation is, okay? That even the justice that we get will come with a lot of brands and labels which are not necessarily complementary, despite the fact that we as a, the deity has been patiently waiting for 491 years for justice, truly establishing that he is a Maryada Purushottam. Okay, so as far as I'm concerned, I think let's be a bit patient. I know this is not exactly something that people would want to listen, but this is... this is how we are slowly beginning to, undo the injustices of history step by step. And let's be optimistic. Let's also remember the lessons that we are supposed to draw from these experiences and accordingly prepare legally, constitutionally, intellectually, intelligently, with a fair amount of information, knowing what is it that we're exactly kind of dealing with, what are the issues, what are the challenges. I think that's what we should be focusing on. Because it's not just about one case. As I said, even before, Sabarimala is not just about Sabarimala. It is about the status of a certain Indic value system in the land of its own origin. That is what you're effectively dealing with. Okay, so it's time to actually teach some of these deracinated media folks and others a couple of lessons and a couple of home truths with logic. Unfortunately, it just so happens that most of these media platforms are major jokes and circuses. You just keep shouting and shouting and shouting. And I was part of one yesterday. But be that as it may, no, it was necessary, because if I had not taken part in it, people would have gotten away with a lot of nonsense. And they would have actually said a lot of things. Of course, credit must go to a lot of other people who participated in that particular show. Padmaji was there, Shilpaji was there, and these people presented effectively and very, very forcefully the point of view of the devotees and especially the women of Kerala. But be that as it may, this is what we have to deal with, this ecosystem, the so-called establishment that does not want you to speak the truth, at least even with civility. I mean, even if I want to say something with facts and logic and calmly point out, this is what has happened. This is the reason. This is the cause. We want justice. Here are the, facts on the anvils of evidence of English law, which we so worship and all that. And yet, I don't get what I want. And I am branded whatnot in the process of being given something that otherwise belongs to me. Theek hai, we'll handle, I think we'll slowly do whatever is necessary to ensure that the balance is set right.
All right, now I wanted to ask you a completely unrelated question, which was more of a philosophical nature, which has actually got to do with morality more and its connection to the jurisdiction and law and how we're going to take things forward in the future. Now, here's my question to you. Obviously, let's assume a scenario comes where, you know, the judges actually do start getting Indic morality or Indic value systems. Let us assume that. Mm. Now, the thing is that even if the judges start getting it, we can't create a situation, Sai, where we reach a stage of nihilism or, you know, where a stage of everything goes. See, morality can't be subjective. There have to be some objective standards, right? So, unfortunately, I mean, Sam Harris actually makes a very interesting argument, but there have been other arguments made in Indic pantheon also, which is, because we're having this discussion in English, so I'm going to use Sam Harris's language, where Sam Harris says there is something called the worst possible misery, right? So, there are some things which can be mapped down till the end, and we can say that the worst possible misery in every case. Now, right. While we want each and every case, not just with each and every religion, I believe even within religions, it should be based on each and every case. This is my personal view. You can disagree with me and correct me if you feel that. Like even within, if we were to judge something in the Islamic world also, I believe it should be case by case. It should not be Islam as a religion all. It should be A activity within Islam, B activity within Islam, and similarly, it should be A activity within Hinduism of that panth. It should be case by case. Now,
there are several schools even within Islam, and I'm not going to again quote the cliche of Sufi Islam. I'm not going to get into that. I'm saying the Salafi Islam, the Hanafi Islam. These are the traditional schools. So even there, it has to be judged on the anvils of what school of thought you follow.
Yeah. So now my point is that if the courts, let us say the courts do accept the argument of, you know, the diversity and plurality of thought. But then my question to you as a legal expert is, we still have to draw that line, that worst possible misery line, where, you know, human rights have to be taken care of, right? We have to worry about human rights. Now, even if we look at the Yuval Noah Harari view that, you know, it's a social construction. Even if it's a social construction, my answer after reading Harari was, so what? It's a social construction.
It's valid. Yeah. He goes on the basis of imagined reality and imagined communities. Be that as it may, that is what has actually kept the social order alive. And in fact, that is what has given birth to the social order.
Yeah. In fact, you had asked this question in the Pondy Litfest and nobody answered it. So my question to you is, where do we draw that line? What is your legal opinion on that?
See, I think dharma at the end of the day, among its multiple definitions and in its broad canvas, is also a restatement of what are human rights, how do you define human rights, and where do human rights end, and where do non-human rights begin, because this world and this universe is not just about human beings. That is the central concept that we reinforce, that every living being has a right under the sun, and it is integral to this entire ecosystem. And I think that's where the entire jurisprudence of Indic environmental jurisprudence comes from. So I think the concept of dharma needs to be understood. The concept of our places of worship and what do they exactly stand for, they need to be understood. There is a serious gap in the lofty heights of our faith system and our philosophical systems. And what we believe is actually our dharma and what we believe is Hinduism. And there is so much of nonsense that we have filled our heads ourselves, because we impute our ideas as Hindu ideas and we give them a Hindu identity or dharmic identity without actually testing them on rigorous anvils of what is the scripture or what is the praman or what is the experience, what is the tradition, what is the philosophy that you test it against for its Hinduness. Okay. And that's exactly why the entire thing about God and God. Arre, there is no God in Hinduism. Yeah, we believe only in deity. In fact, this is one of the things that is the subject matter of discussion in these HRC legislations, because the Hindu religious and charitable endowment legislations require the trustees of temples and executive officers must believe in God. We don't want people who believe in God. We want people who believe in Hindu deities, who believe in the mode of worship as far as that particular temple is concerned or that particular institution is concerned. So, for instance, Sri K. Parasaran, during the course of his arguments, also gave the example of the Chidambaram temple, which is where the Akashalingam exists, where there is no deity, where there is no idol, so to speak. There is a deity, but there is no idol. Imagine. Okay. That's the beauty of this particular faith. Unfortunately, I think we have moved so far away from our roots that I think these discussions are actually meant for perfumed atmospheres. And perhaps once people start taking the baby step of going to the closest temple, understand that particular institution, and once they come closer to their roots, they'll automatically understand dharma better. They'll also understand human rights better.
All right, cool. So I just wanted to take now a couple of super chats. So somebody, T. Pooja, had asked this question. Arguments I came across don't contest the presence of Ram Lalla temple, but they do claim it to be a violent victory because of the demolition of the mosque. Legally, they aren't wrong, or are they? So somebody had asked.
The demolition of the disputed structure has got nothing to do with the merits of the case, because what established the case, largely speaking, is the excavation that was undertaken under the disputed structure, which proved the existence of a non-Islamic structure. Okay, that would have happened even if the demolition of 6th of December 1992 had not taken place, and if people had simply followed the directions of excavating that place for archaeological evidence. The reason, and people have to ask themselves, why was the ASI excavation initiated in the 1980s and 90s? Because until then, the position that was taken was, there is no, we have a right to this particular place of worship. As far as the Hindu claim is concerned, there is nothing underneath. That was the original position. Then to call the bluff of this position, when the court decided to direct excavation, then they decided to change the position. Okay, there may be some structure underneath, which is not an Islamic structure, but there is no proof of demolition. Okay. Then when other evidence started coming out, they started saying, so what if there is a demolition? Who knows if somebody called Ram even existed? So from whether Ram Mandir existed, we went to the extent of whether Ram existed. Okay. That is the extent to which they pushed this entire argument. So, the Asaduddin Owaisi school of thought effectively believes that had it not been for the demolition of 6th of December 1992, we would have lost the case. Utter nonsense. There is no legal basis for this. As I said before, and I have said this in response to Malini Parthasarathy's comment, legally unlettered, uninformed, absolutely unscrupulous, because that's not how it works. Even if you want to apply the lofty so-called standards of English law, that's not how it works. The demolition of that particular disputed structure had got nothing to do with the outcome of the particular case. The facts of the case would have been established even if the structure had stood until the date of the judgment, because the excavation was proving everything otherwise.
All right. So now one last question and then we can wrap things up. Right. I don't know how to put it. So I'm going to try and put it in the most precise way possible.
Because my laptop is running out of battery and I don't have my charger next to me.
Oh, damn. So my question was actually something to do with, okay, can you clarify, are you an atheist, Sai Deepak? Somebody has asked.
Are you?
This is what happens when you talk to me.
We should never use the word theist or atheist or a believer as far as we are concerned. The test is Gnostic and Astic, and it is not based on existence or denial of God or deity. It is based on denial of Vedas as the primary Pramana. Okay. Whoever believes in the Veda is an Astik. Whoever does not believe in Veda is a Gnostic. Okay? So, Nirishwarvadis are not necessarily Gnostics. They may believe in Nirishwarvadism and they could still believe in the Veda. That would make them, according to me, an Astik within the meaning of the Vedic tradition, but a Nirishwarvadi nevertheless. Okay? As far as I am concerned, I believe that Vedas represent the journey of humankind. It is a huge cultural, religious, and civilizational repository for the entire world to cherish. And therefore, I believe that they are worthy of being protected. Whether they are worthy of being believed or not, frankly speaking, I am untrained in it. I have not read it, unfortunately. I don't have training in the Vedas. That's one of my deepest regrets. And hopefully, by the time I touch the age of 40 or 45, I'll at least have learned something of it. And in the language it is supposed to be learned, which is Sanskrit and not any other language. So that is something that I'd certainly love to. So I don't know what to say. I certainly have very strong belief in the concept of a temple, in the concept of a deity. Okay. So I hope that answers that question. There is a decent chance that thanks to the issues that I've been handling, my own belief in these issue, in these aspects have only been strengthened. There is a decent chance that I was not as religious perhaps maybe a decade ago. Not that I was irreligious or an atheist in the way it is understood, but perhaps I've gravitated more towards these issues as time has passed. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, I'm sure it answers the question. And just to clarify, even I'm not an atheist. I just did a monologue of why I don't call myself an atheist. I'm a Gnostic and I'm a Nirishwarvadi. So, you know, just for everybody who's going to be watching this, but it's a complicated issue. And anyways, I think we've crossed the 50-minute mark. And, you know, you had told me that you were hard-pressed for time. So maybe, you know, we can do this. We can continue this discussion maybe sometime in the future. I had a few philosophical queries in relation to this. We can revisit them sometime in the future. Sure. We can definitely look into that. So, guys, once again, thanks a lot for viewing the podcast today. I'm sorry we have to wrap things up at 50 minutes. You must be shocked that Kushal Mehra podcast pe aur 50 minute mein baat khatam ho rahi hai, magar aaj hume karna hai. But I'll definitely request you guys, if you have any other questions, you know, please, 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 you know, you can write to me or you can write to Op India. I mean, if you want to write to Op India, I'm just going to share the link. You have, you know, if you see the screen, there is the Op India screen. I would always tell you, you know, subscribe to Op India, subscribe to the Charvak podcast and support Op India. This is the support link to Op India. And also, if you like what I do on my podcast, you can go on patreon.com and you can support it. So Sai, once again, thank you very much for coming on the podcast and I'll see you next time.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for the opportunity. Thank you for the viewers for actually watching this so patiently. Thanks a lot.
All right. Take care, guys. Until next time. See ya.